This is Thinking About OBGYN with your hosts, Antonia Roberts and Howard Harrell.
Antonia.
Howard.
What are we thinking about on today's episode?
Well, something called the angle of progression and also some other updates. But first, what's a thing we do for no reason?
Well, how about doing a two-layer closure at the time of a cesarean delivery, or maybe I should say cesarean birth. I think that's what we're supposed to be saying these days anyway.
Okay, sure. Delivery, birth, the baby is coming out, or whatever. Do we have to talk about semantics?
Well, I don't really care so much one way or the other, but if you haven't noticed, our professional societies and ACOG have started to change away from the word delivery to the word birth. I don't mind that one so much, primarily because people have tended to, I think, misunderstand what the word delivery really means. And the term, as we use it, it's changed in the last 50 or 60 years. But we are talking about birth after all, so the word birth has some merit. I've always tried to avoid saying cesarean section, though I'm sure I slip up sometimes. People may go back and find episodes where I've said it and send us emails. But it is redundant if you understand that the word cesarean means to cut and the word section means to cut. So there's nothing in there about birth, just cut.
This was a pet peeve of one of my attendings in residency. And he liked to tell everyone he could about how saying the phrase cesarean section is just like saying cut.
Sounds like my kind of guy, honestly.
Yeah, he is quite a character. So this brings up some fond memories of Dr. Daner, in case he's listening. But
good job, Dr. Daner.
To be fair, we rarely use the word section when we're talking about cutting anything else besides a uterus. And certainly we never use the word cesarean for talking about cutting anything else. Like, I don't cesarean myself a slice of pizza or anything. So I can understand why we don't think of them as being the same word and why we use them together.
You don't section your pizza or your cake?
No.
What about the word vivisection? There's a medical term.
Well, that's just a more grotesque way of describing surgery, right? Like, if you say birth by vivisection, it just sounds terrible. I'd rather be redundant and say C-section instead.
Well, I think back in the day, they used to cut people open while they were still alive so they could study anatomy and physiology. I mean, it specifically means cutting someone open just for an experimental purpose, not for treatment. So thankfully, that doesn't apply to cesareans. And I think vivisection is generally frowned upon now, so that's why we don't hear about it as much.
Well, actually, that reminds me, and this is something you probably knew already, but even as recently as the 1980s, so probably around the time I was born, they were still routinely doing symphysiotomies on laboring women in certain places in Ireland.
And in Africa, Northern Africa.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that part I didn't know, but they would cut right through their pubic bones to get the baby out while still awake, of course. And this wasn't even in the setting of shoulder dystocia, which that's how we will normally hear it talked about as a very absolute last resort that pretty much never happens for shoulder dystocia, but they were doing this just for routine births. So obviously it's, I'd say, horrific and unconscionable, probably even by the standards at the time, let alone our current standards.
Well, unless it serves some therapeutic purpose, like the baby was stuck, I guess.
Yeah, see, that's what I don't know about. So there's a lot of articles about this now, and it's been described in some of these articles as a toxic mix of experimentation, so which is what you said vivisection is,
yeah,
and aversion, like a Catholic aversion in Ireland to cesareans. I don't know about Northern Africa.
And probably just, unrelated.
Yeah. And then a disregard for women in general. And sometimes in Ireland, they would even do it after a cesarean, after the baby was already out, because they would think that her pelvis was too small, so they're going to prophylactically open her pelvis to help her avoid a future cesarean by doing a symphysiotomy.
That does seem toxic.
Yeah. So I think that their reasoning was that they thought that if a woman has multiple cesareans, so multiple scars on her uterus, then when she gets pregnant in the future, it'll be too dangerous and it may not carry to term, or God forbid, she might even terminate the pregnancy. I don't know. But they wanted to promote women having maximal babies, maximal full-term pregnancies. And so they wanted to avoid cesareans at all costs. And this even came from the very head of Dublin's National Maternity Hospital in the 1940s.
I've been there.
And, well, that's neat. I have not been there. But yeah, so that's where the push for symphysiotomies came from. So I guess you could say that those births with symphysiotomies were births by vivisection.
Well, I've never done a birth by vivisection then, so.
Me neither. I don't.
I trust you have a linked an article about this. We can.
I do. I have. Well, there's many. I have one link, but it's from a, not from a medical journal.
We'll
but,
take it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So there is a whole history of symphysiotomy, which technically is cutting the symphysis pubis, the ligament itself. And then there was also pubotomy or hebostotomy, which was cutting the bone, the actual pelvis. And so it turns out that the bone heals better if you can get the bone approximated to bone. It heals a lot better than does the pubic symphysis. And I think we talked on here before that the concept of the chainsaw was actually invented by an obstetrician as a little handheld saw with the idea of using that as a tool to cut the symphysis. But people also used a wire saw, a giggly saw, and they would take a needle like we use with a TVT trocar, and they would pass it behind the pubic bone and then have two little handles on a wire saw and cut the bone. And then you'd have this bone that needed to be approximated under a lot of pressure in order for it to heal, or you'd have the ligament, which would never quite heal right no matter what. And either way, you had to lay women on their sides and bind them together and lay them there for a week or two, hoping that it would heal back together. But of course, they had severe dyspareunia and they had chronic pain and urinary incontinence, and because of these symphysiotomies or hebotomies. But it didn't affect their fertility, I guess, so that was okay. They could still get pregnant, but so thankfully, I guess those women you were telling me are getting reparations, and some of the offenders are getting called out finally for these procedures.
Yeah. Yeah. Gosh, that's just crazy to even visualize for a minute. But I guess that was a little bit of a tangent. We were a tangent of a tangent. We were talking about just saying the word birth instead of delivery. Yeah. So yeah, I think I have noticed that in our literature today, it seems like that's how people are talking and writing. I'm not sure if it's an intentional change for the sake of change, or if there really is some kind of historical reason for that.
Well, I do think that it does have something to do with just what the word delivery means and doesn't mean, and the difference in how Americans use it and the English use it and things like that. But we can do a historical tidbit in a minute. We're on a tangent of a tangent of a tangent.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Fair enough. You did also mention, you reminded me that you slip up sometimes when you say stuff, and I do too. So a couple episodes ago, we talked about gender discrimination and chauvinism, and we got a listener email. They pointed out that you seemed in one part of that podcast to make a contradistinction between American women and Muslim women. You were describing some studies as if those were mutually exclusive categories somehow. So do you have any defense for this, or was that just a slip up?
You're still on a tangent. Well, I did say something like that, but I would say that I was actually deliberately trying to make a distinction between the average American woman and what she wants in a male or female obstetrician gynecologist, because we were citing studies that included American women, regardless of ethnicity or national origin or anything like that. And then we cited another study that included Muslim women. And those women were explicitly included because of their religious status. And the women in that study were not, in fact, American, but they were all from Turkey. It was a Turkish study. So specifically, Muslim women from Turkey in one study versus generic American women in another study. So I didn't mean to imply that Muslim women can't be American, but the two particular studies happened to focus on American women as distinct from Muslim women from Turkey.
Well, so yeah, maybe we should have just gone into full detail about those studies the first time we talked about it, because if you leave room for interpretation, sometimes you don't always get the benefit of the doubt. So let's recap on it now. This was about, like you said, what gender do women patients prefer that their doctors are, male or female? I don't think either of these studies included an option for preferring a transgender or non-binary doctor.
But you're really covering all the bases now, I see.
Right. But if we are comparing two different studies and we're comparing the preferences of American women to the preferences of Turkish women, regardless even of faith status or not, then we would have to control for the differences in the doctors and the medical profession and the medical practice in each country. The Muslim women in Turkey, as we noted, were less likely than the American women in the other study to prefer a female doctor. But we didn't really talk about, like, what's the percentage of female doctors in Turkey to begin with? And could they have some other reason for believing that women are not as well suited to be doctors as men in Turkey? Maybe the medical societies in Turkey, maybe they really are just as serious about gender equality as the medical societies are in the US. Maybe they're trained exactly the same way in both countries and are interchangeable. But even then, there would still be some undeniable cultural differences to consider.
Well, I looked it up, and females comprise 43.17%, according to a study I found, very specific, of Turkey's OBGYN workforce, at least. But you're right. There's a ton of other cultural factors we have to consider. And I think I was really actually complimenting Turkish women on having less implicit bias than American women, and implying that American culture maybe has contributed to the bias of preferring a female provider over a male in a way that Turkish culture hasn't. But maybe it's actually reverse discrimination, and maybe women in Turkey prefer men because of an implicit bias against women in that country. So it really is tough to know the answers to those questions.
Okay, fair enough. Well, hopefully that clears things up a bit. So maybe you can just apologize for what you said and we can move on.
All right, well, mea culpa. Or perhaps I should say, ana asif.
Oh boy, I hope that's correct. I don't know.
Maybe someone can pronounce it better for us.
Hopefully we didn't just cause a bunch more hate mail to come my way. Well, anyway, let's get back off our tangent to this cesarean issue of things we do for no reason. You said that we're doing two-layer closures on the uterine hysterotomy at the time of cesarean birth for no reason, which neither of us do, but that is still commonly done by others. Now, we talked about this way back in an episode in season 2 when we discussed the cesarean birth technique. Anyway, you said that you do one-layer closure because they're quicker and they have less blood loss, and you admitted that the literature at the time wasn't clear of whether a one-layer closure versus two-layer closure was associated with more future uterine ruptures in their subsequent pregnancies. But now it seems like you're acting like you're a lot more certain about even that point. I think before you said you wouldn't necessarily judge anyone who did two layers for that reason. And that's actually how I was trained to do it, two layers, back in my day. But at the time, you wouldn't have judged that because the literature was mixed. But so far, now you sound very judgy. So what's changed here?
I noticed you said cesarean birth, by the way. Good job. Well, I think we know more today than we had available to us in the time of that discussion, or at least in our knowledge sets at the time of that discussion. And today we can cite an article that agrees with my premise, and also where new literature is showing some agreement from leading experts. So in November of 2020, there was a current commentary in the Green Journal, and we mentioned this before, called The Case for Standardizing Cesarean Delivery Technique, Seeing the Forest for the Trees. The authors make the argument for doing a cesarean delivery that is incredibly close in technique to what I've been doing for many years, even before that article came out. In fact, I learned about this article not because I read it at the time it was in the Green Journal, but because a former student reached out to me and said that they had read it and were surprised or shocked or something at how much it agreed with the technique that I had taught. So naturally, I was curious. But they recommend a one-layer closure, and I'm not going to argue with them. Specifically, they talk about the Coronis trial, which we mentioned before, but there's three-year follow-up data from that study. And in that three-year follow-up data, they had women who were randomized to single versus double layer closure. And within 3 years afterwards, there were about 1,600 women in each group who had subsequent pregnancies. Now, there were 674 women in a one-layer group who subsequently labored, and 3 of those women experienced a uterine rupture, while 680 women in the double-layer closure arm subsequently labored within 3 years, and 4 of those patients experienced a uterine rupture. There was really no other differences in outcomes. So if you combine that with what we already know about blood loss and operative speed and those sorts of things, then I think it's incredibly hard at this point to cite any favorable evidence for doing a two-layer closure. And any studies that you might think of or that you might refer to are usually poorly controlled retrospective studies that have all begged for some sort of prospective randomized trial, and here it is. So this is our best evidence, and if anything, you might say that the rupture risk is greater in the two-layer group since they had 25% more ruptures.
Does it make physiologic sense that the risk of uterine rupture would be greater after two-layer closure?
Well, I think we have to be careful when we talk about what might make sense or might not make sense. That's how we start getting into bad practices and some narrative fallacies. So remember, I'm a skeptical empiricist, not a theorist. But you're right, people have certainly speculated in the literature that a two-layer closure will approximate more tissue and therefore make a better scar. But I could also theorize that a two-layer closure will cause a decrease in the blood supply to the tissue that needs to heal well and therefore make a weaker scar. So we shouldn't do anything based upon the theory of why something seems to work, particularly not when we have empiric data. And if you accept evidence-based medicine as the standard of practice, I think it would be very difficult at this point to justify a two-layer closure in the landscape of what's available today in terms of evidence. But yes, this is the stuff that causes us to keep doing things like tocolytics or fundal heights or progesterone for prevention of preterm birth or some of the unnecessary cerclages we see or lots of things. Or as we talked about recently, why you might want to keep doing an amnioinfusion to dilute meconium stained fluid or deep suctioning at meconium births. So the theory is not what's important, but rather the empirical evidence from experimental studies.
Well, to get really nitty gritty with uterine closure technique, I think there's still a few open questions regarding how each layer or how the single layer is sutured. So, for example, could future uterine rupture risk theoretically be lower if the closure is done in a running, not locked fashion because there's less occlusion of the blood vessels?
Less tissue ischemia.
Yeah, less ischemia rather than locked. Or what about not trying to pierce the endometrium with the suture? Could that save a patient from future cesarean scar defects or adenomyosis or something? This article that by Dahlke, the standardizing cesarean delivery technique, mentioned that the greatest myometrial thickness measured by ultrasound has been found with a two-layer closure, at least in the kind where the first layer was not locked. But then they say that's an ultrasound measurement that hasn't been correlated to any kind of clinical outcomes like protection from uterine rupture or anything. And so that's why they still recommend just the one layer. And all of these kind of nitty gritty questions really are precisely the kind of things that can be adequately studied only when everything else really is done as identically as possible by using a standardized technique. And I would agree with this article that the evidence supporting these different examples of locked or not locked, single, double, or piercing the endometrium is really at best, it's weak evidence. But I still will see some variation, even in a setting, a practice setting where the overall consensus is utilize the standardized approach, exactly as how this article presents it. And I think it really is worth reviewing multiple times. That's why we're reviewing it again, even though we reviewed it before on this podcast. And I think it's hard to argue against a standard technique for especially this surgery, but any surgery really. And of course, we can make changes over time to the standard as the evidence evolves, but maintaining still a standard technique helps everyone get really good at doing it the best way that they currently know to do. And then that sets them up to conduct studies that can change only one or two variables and do it in large enough quantities that we can get really strong and reliable data that informs best practices. And this is how quality and safety improvements are made in the manufacturing industry. And the concept of reducing unnecessary variation is incredibly important in improving healthcare outcomes as well. So maybe we're still on our things we do for no reason, but why don't we run through that checklist from the article really quickly of how do they do cesareans. It may vary maybe by one point or two of what we discussed in that episode in this season two, but I think we can just run it in just a couple minutes.
Yeah, it's a good reminder for folks if they're not doing some of these things. So they have in there a nice table, a list of recommendations for the surgeon, and then also one for the hospital or the institution. So I'll go through the surgeon list quickly. They recommend the Joel Cohn style of abdominal entry, which is making a transverse incision 2 or 3 centimeters above the pubic symphysis, dissecting the fat and fascia sharply in the middle, and then using blunt subcutaneous and fascial expansion, omitting the dissection of the superior and inferior rectus sheath off the fascia, and then blunt peritoneal entry. So basically what we discussed in the recent episode about speed of cesarean, that difference of omitting the dissection of the rectus sheath off the fascia, just how people do stat sections, honestly. I know that sounds weird to people who don't do it all the time, meaning the not doing the step of taking the muscles off the fascia. But in something like 1,200 cesareans, I've probably done it less than 20 or 30 times, maybe in cases where there was just really dense scarring. And it's just not a problem to omit it. And it saves a lot of time and bleeding and pain for the patient.
I know I've talked about this with you before, but I think blunt dissection and retraction in general in a cesarean can take a lot of strength, specifically extending the fascial incisions by pulling on it with my hands. Sometimes I just can't. And then I have to go for the scissors. And also separating the rectus muscles from each other in the midline bluntly without having lifted off that fascia. Sometimes for whatever reason, I just can't. I have to get the fascia off and then I can pull the muscles apart. I have tried omitting it before and I can maybe get a few centimeters apart. So of course, sometimes when the muscles are completely fused together in the midline and to the fascia, like in some repeat cesareans, then doing that dissection really does seem like the best option to avoid cutting through the muscles. But I'm always open to continuing to work on omitting that step, especially if I can learn a hack for it. I don't know if I just have to lift more weights or what it is, but I do that dissection step a lot just because I haven't figured out how to bluntly muscle it open.
I think one thing I would say is just involve your assistant, like split the work in half. So be very comfortable having your assistant pull against you and you go one way, they go the other way. And then not assuming that you need the rectus muscles separated as much as you might think. And that's the part, that's the Roger Bannister 4-minute mile. Roger Bannister ran a mile in 4 minutes when everybody said it was impossible. And then as soon as he did, 30 people did in a few months. And I think this is true of that too. Once you deliver a couple of dozen babies without having done the step, you'll forget it that you ever did it.
I'd say the other part of that too is that, yeah, we get stuck in our ways and we're used to doing things the way we were trained and it's hard to venture away from that. And this was how I was trained to dissect the fascia off the muscles. And it has been the norm everywhere I've worked at since I started training. So I was trained and then all my colleagues were also trained the same way. And that's how they all, pretty much how they all do it as well. But we can't deny the fact that this article makes the argument that we just need to bite the bullet and change when the evidence changes and not dissect the fascia off the rectus, I guess.
Okay, well, they go on. We still have to deliver a baby. So the next steps are don't make a bladder flap. Make a small 2 to 3 centimeter low transverse incision in the uterus sharply, and then use cephalocaudate expansion with your fingers bluntly. Let the placenta deliver spontaneously or with cord traction without sticking your hand in the uterus. Don't clean the inside of the uterus out unless you see membranes or placenta visibly left inside. Don't mechanically dilate the undilated cervix. Repair the uterus after exteriorizing it with a single layer closure, a running locked layer, presumably full thickness, but they don't specify that. Don't do intra-abdominal irrigation. Don't close the peritoneum or reapproximate the rectus muscles. Don't change your gloves after delivery of the baby before doing the closure. Do a simple running suture to close the fascia. Do irrigate the subcutaneous tissue and close the subcutaneous tissue if it's more than 2 centimeters deep, and then close the skin with a subcuticular suture.
Okay, great. And I think everything there is what you do, except for irrigating the sub-Q, right?
Yeah, I think that's the only step really that's different for me. I will say that they say there's only one randomized controlled trial of 185 women, and that study found no difference with this practice in surgical site infections, which to me would be the main reason to do it. But in that one study, there were fewer hematomas and seroma formations. It's interesting that there were less hematomas and seromas, but that didn't lead to any decrease in infections. Now, that paper was published in 2018, and I'll admit that I had not seen it until I looked up the footnote that they cited. They apparently did not use glue over those incisions, and they found these hematomas and seromas sort of by careful inspection of the wounds because they were doing the study, not necessarily because they cause symptoms or problems for the patients, and certainly not because they cause infections. So I'm not sure that based upon that one study using a skin dressing technique that I do not use, that I'm ready to change my practice, particularly when I just don't see patients coming back with hematomas or seromas. But I'll do that one bit if everyone else agrees to adopt all the other changes that they've not been doing, just so we're all on the same page.
How brave of you.
I'll change.
Okay. Well, let me go through the things they recommended for the institutions or the hospitals. They recommended prophylactic antibiotics before the skin incision is made, add azithromycin if the patient's already in labor, has ruptured membranes. They recommend SCDs, sequential compression devices. They do not recommend left lateral tilt. They do recommend standard operating room warming interventions for the mother. They do not recommend supplemental oxygen or a preoperative enema, thankfully.
How posh.
They do recommend chlorhexidine alcohol skin prep. They recommend iodine vaginal prep if there's already advanced labor or ruptured membranes. They recommend an indwelling Foley catheter in the bladder. They do not recommend adhesive drapes. They do not recommend barrier retractors, so like the Alexis retractor. They do recommend prophylactic oxytocin to prevent hemorrhage, and they recommend using blunt tip needles instead of the cutting type for suturing whenever it's available. They recommend omitting negative pressure wound therapy for all patients. And we've talked about some of those things too. In particular, the lack of evidence for the negative pressure wound units and also the lack of evidence for left lateral tilt. So altogether, they would recommend against routinely leaving the uterus inside and routinely using an Alexis retractor to repair the uterus or using negative pressure wound devices ever, like prophylactically, I suppose, not if they actually come back with a wound dehiscence, then do what you need to do, but to prophylactically use it even on select cases with patients with multiple risk factors for wound complications, they say don't do it. And I think besides those things, the stuff that maybe doesn't get done as routinely as it should is the addition of azithromycin for patients already in labor. Although at least at my institution, I think we're pretty on top of that. And also the vaginal prep for those patients, especially when they have ruptured membranes, although there was just a new study
this month, and evidence does change. This paper was published in 2020, and admittedly, that vaginal prep for those already in labor with ruptured membranes was one of the weaker evidenced items, but they went with it because the evidence tended to support it. But there is a randomized controlled trial in the December 2022 Gray Journal that says it's ineffective, so we're allowed to revise the list a little bit. But yes, I agree.
Yeah, that is hot off the press, and I don't know if incorporating that into the weight of the data, it is a stronger study. So yeah.
Maybe we'll look at that in the upcoming episodes and see how that compares with what we already know.
Yeah.
But yes, I agree that with what you said, and I also agree with the spirit of the paper, as you did, I think, which argues for us all adopting a standardized technique and then improving beyond that. And I can tell you just from my own experiences, though, in trying to get docs to adopt delayed cord clamping, you know, that extra 60 seconds, that massively changing a person's surgical techniques or habits is probably going to be incredibly difficult.
All right. Now let's catch up a bit. What was your historical tidbit about the word delivery?
Oh, yeah. Well, so I was researching this for the new book I'm writing, and actually the title of the book plays off of this. So today we talk about delivering the baby, but historically we talked about delivering the mother. Now the British still do. They do a better job of reminding us English speakers what the word delivery or deliver originally meant, because they still today talk about delivering the mother of the baby and not delivering the baby from the mother as if it were a package or a pizza or something to be delivered. So the word deliver has a couple of different meanings, and we have assumed the wrong meaning in our general American conversations in the last half century or so. The original meaning means to save someone from something. I might deliver you out of a dangerous situation or deliver you from danger into safety. The second meaning, obviously, is to deliver a thing like deliver a package. But when we talk about delivering women of their babies, we need to save them from the danger that exists while they're pregnant and in the labor process. And that's how it was originally used in the English language and still is in England today. Let me read some Shakespeare to you from the Comedy of Errors, which, of course, is a play about mixing up twins at birth. So all obstetricians know this one. But this is from the Comedy of Errors. There had she not been long, but she became a joyful mother of two goodly sons, and, which was strange, the one so like the other as could not be distinguished but by names. That very hour, and in the selfsame inn, a meaner woman was delivered of such a burden. Male twins, both alike, those, for their parents were exceedingly poor, I bought and brought up to attend to my sons. Okay, well, so the line there is, this woman was delivered of such a burden, and by being delivered of her twins. So you notice that this burden was the act of being pregnant, compounded by the fact that she was pregnant with twins. She was doubly burdened by the risks of pregnancy. One of the earliest English usages that we have comes from 1325, from a homily of the New Testament book of Luke that speaks of Mary being pregnant or being delivered with Jesus. For then come to Mary mild, so to be delivered of her child, and son shall delivered was. Basically, Mary was delivered of her child, the standard way that English speakers used this term back in the day. Bradley's New English Dictionary from 1888 defines the word in this context as meaning to disburden the woman of the fetus. 100 or 200 years ago, people generally understood that the condition of pregnancy was very dangerous, with around 2% of children dying in the act of childbirth and many more dying in the neonatal period. And remember that 1 in 8 or maybe 1 in 9 women died from childbirth in their lifetimes. So having a baby was no walk in the park, and there were no options for pain relief or emergency treatments or anything like that if things should go wrong. So the literature and the poetry and everything of the time records that women were really frightened and uneasy with the idea of pregnancy and the burden and the dangers associated with it. And when they had their baby, they were delivered of that burden. They made it through and survived the burden of pregnancy. But today, women don't think of pregnancy, I think, in such dangerous terms. So the word delivery, in American English at least, has changed to emphasize the baby being handed to her almost.
Yeah, almost as if now that pregnancy isn't so dangerous to the moms, we just assume the other meaning of delivery, like deliver this package out of the mom into the obstetrician's arms. But I wonder, too, if it could actually be the other way. Like, now the pregnancy is so much safer for the mom that now we're just thinking about the risks to the baby. And now let's deliver the baby out of the danger of the unknown intrauterine environment into the safety.
That definitely is true. I mean, from the 1960s on, obstetrics has focused on improving neonatal and infant mortality and perinatal mortality after we plateaued with maternal mortality. And we invented electronic fetal monitoring and all the things, C-section becoming more commonplace, and all the things that really emphasize safe passage for the baby rather than preservation of the mother. So you may be right.
Well, I think it still makes sense to use the word delivery when...
Birth. Come on. Just do okay. Birth. Birth. It's a birth, and birth has dangers for the mother and the baby. And we're here to take care of both.
Well, anyway, let's get on to our new favorite topic, the angle of progression.
Yes, this does make me excited.
Well, it's probably something that a lot of our listeners, including both the professional obstetricians and all of our other friends, mothers and students and everyone else, have never heard of. I had never heard of it until you told me about it very recently. But there is a whole new developing literature about this point of care ultrasound measurement, which is called the angle of progression. And you've recently been utilizing it in clinical practice more and more. I have not had the chance to use it yet. And you and I have been discussing about what its proper use should be. It does seem interesting and like something that potentially could reduce the risk of cesarean births.
Yes, births. You did it. Yes.
Well, I'm very adaptable. You can reduce the risk of cesarean birth for some people in particular with this measurement.
Yeah, I think so. So let's, yeah, we should get into it.
Okay. So this angle is something that you measure with an ultrasound transperineally, usually during the second stage of labor. For example, when you're worried about whether or not she's going to be able to give birth vaginally after she's been pushing for a while. So you take a normal abdominal ultrasound probe and put a glove on it to keep it clean, and then put it right at the perineum in the sagittal plane. So the probe is basically oriented straight up and down against, or maybe slightly in between, the labia. So then what are you looking at?
I'll put a picture, of course, on the website of some of these ultrasounds and a graphic that demonstrates this if you're having a hard time visualizing what we're talking about. But yes, once you've done what you just said, you've got the ultrasound probe there, you're looking for a sagittal cross-section of the pubic symphysis at the top of the image, and then the fetal presenting part, usually the skull or the head, underneath the pubic symphysis, and then freeze or print that image. Then you draw a line through the pubic symphysis running from the superior through the inferior margins of the bone, just right down the middle. This will essentially be parallel to the mother's backbone. And another line starting from the inferior margin of the pubic bone and just going tangentially across the most distal bony presenting part of the fetus, which again is usually the scalp. So this line will be pointed downwards away from the first line, or posteriorly and inferiorly, assuming that the baby's head is engaged past the maternal pubic bone.
Okay, so the lower down the head is past maternal pubic bone, then the wider this angle is between these two lines. I think I still need help understanding why measuring this angle is better than doing a digital exam for assessing fetal station, because that seems like that's getting essentially the same information, but it's a lot easier and much lower tech.
Yeah, I think the station obviously is a big part of it, but I do think there's something more to it. And people have used ultrasound measurements just to get an objective measurement of the actual descent of the fetal head. And that too is a very significant predictor of success of spontaneous vaginal delivery or success with instrumental vaginal delivery. But I do think it measures something a little bit more than just descent. That's certainly a big component of it. And obviously, it's why the angle's greater if you measure it while the mother is pushing versus while she's not pushing, because it can be measured either way. So I think it's a combination of descent as well as having a wider intertuberous diameter. So the intertuberous diameter is the distance between the ischial tuberosities, or some call them the sit bones. If the intertuberous diameter is wider, the fetus will have room to be closer to the symphysis pubis. So even at plus one station, the angle can be quite wide because you're drawing a line almost straight down from the pubic bone axis. But if the intertuberous diameter is smaller, then it'll have the effect of pushing the fetus back more towards the maternal sacrum. So in this situation, the same cervical exam at plus one station would have a smaller angle, almost perpendicular to the pubic bone axis. And obviously, a bigger intertuberous diameter, we know just from pelvimetry, is better.
Okay, well, there's some old school pelvimetry we have to talk about then. The size of the pelvic outlet is defined by the width of the intertuberous diameter rather than between the ischial spines or some other measurement. And that is measured as the line between the closest bony points of the ischial tuberosities. So the inner margins. But I've never seen this measurement done in practice or even discussed in practice.
We don't really do it anymore, for sure.
Right. So some other pelvimetry measurements from, I think, really before the times of ultrasound include the sagittal pelvic outlet diameter, which is the distance from the front to the back between the closest point of the sacrococcygeal joint and the pubic symphysis. But I think your explanation of the range of different possible angles with the same fetal station does make sense to me if I look at a picture of it while I'm thinking through those scenarios. So I would definitely encourage our listeners to look at a picture of the angle of progression whenever they get a chance, if it's not really clicking just by hearing us talk about it.
Yeah, and it is. And I understand why it's confusing, particularly when we don't do all of this pelvimetry stuff anymore. We talk about like android and gynecoid and platypoid pelvises and stuff like that. But really, people are not good at them. In the old days, the best we really had were things like the obstetric conjugate, estimating for the true conjugate, which really just gets that front to back space a little bit, but doesn't tell us about the width and the shape of the pelvis. So the shapes were really just based upon experience. And we don't do these things enough, and we certainly don't use x-rays anymore, but that was standard even in the 80s and certainly in the 70s, where you could look at an x-ray and tell the shape of someone's pelvis. So I think that's maybe where the angle of progression has a role, is in bringing back some of what we lost by not being good or even really thinking about shapes of pelvises anymore. I think the other thing that I would say about this issue about the intertuberous distance is, if it's more narrow, which is bad, then the pelvic arch will be more acute. And so to me, that's really the key part, is if the pelvic arch is more acute, then it pushes that head down away from the pubic bone as it progresses down, and the angle will be smaller. Now, that's essentially, if you look at pictures of pelvic shapes, that's essentially saying that a woman has an android pelvis, or at least a narrower arch in the middle. So I think that it's getting at both of all of those things as a function of the total shape and just the volume of space available. But yes, it may, all this just may be another way of saying this pelvis has a narrower arch, is more android or platypoid perhaps in shape than it is gynecoid, and gynecoid pelvises are going to do better. Clinically, it's almost impossible to tell apart different pelvic bone shapes in some sort of objective way. You really can't measure the intertuberous diameter at the bedside in a reliable way. So I think this measurement will account for the station and some parts of the maternal pelvis better than a simple digital check. And I should say that in the cases where we're doing this, you're also worried about a lot of caput and a lot of swelling. And it is very hard sometimes to tell what you're feeling, where the actual skull is in relationship to the ischial spines when there's just a significant amount of caput.
Okay, so theoretically, if I did a cervical exam and someone was only plus one, but then I also did this angle of progression and they had a really wide angle, that would tell me that this is probably a very roomy pelvis, and that there's a good chance that this is going to happen vaginally. Whereas,
yeah, it might reassure you to give somebody more time.
Yeah.
In our current labor guidelines, we talk about extending even to 4 hours or longer. And sometimes it's hard clinically, like, is she pushing really well and has just made no progress? Or does she have a dense epidural and maybe she's not pushing so well? So I think it might embolden you to give someone more time when they're up against some of these limits.
Okay. Yeah. So I think I'm seeing how this could be useful then. So you measure the angle between those two lines that you draw on the image that you take, but you can't just have the ultrasound automatically do that. So are you whipping out a protractor, or how are you actually doing this?
Well, I suppose you could whip out your protractor if you keep it next to your slide rule. But yeah, the ultrasound machine, mine on labor and delivery, doesn't have a printer, so I can't print it off and then sit down with a protractor. And I don't normally carry my protractor and compass around, though I'll admit I do have a protractor and compass in my office.
Why do you have a protractor and compass in your office?
Well, I, as a hobby, love geometric construction. So sometimes I'll construct geometric forms for fun.
Oh, dear. I think there's some things that maybe you just shouldn't say in public.
I might get fan mail for that, okay? There may be some other geometrists out there. But anyway, I can edit that out if you think I'm going to get hate mail.
No, just don't worry.
But what I practically do on labor and delivery is I get the image on there, and then I just take my phone out and take a picture of it on the screen, the good picture I've got with everything properly displayed. And then I downloaded this free app called Angle Meter on iPhone. I can load the picture into Angle Meter, and it's just got a protractor on there with 3 points that you just place. So I put a point at the top of the symphysis and a point at the bottom, and then a point that draws a line tangent to the skull, and then it calculates the angle for me, so I can do all that really quickly. And I can put a picture of one of those on the website too, so people can see what I mean.
Okay, and then do you normally measure this while they're pushing or at rest?
Well, you can do both, and there's different studies that apply to pushing or not pushing, but I've just been doing it at rest primarily because most of the studies do it at rest.
Okay, so you do these measurements, you use your Angle Meter app, and you get a number. So what do these numbers mean?
Well, the different angles can be used to predict the likelihood of a spontaneous vaginal delivery and also of a successful, uncomplicated instrumental delivery, forceps or vacuums. So in February of 2022, there was a meta-analysis of 8 studies published that looked at how the angle of progression has been studied. And this included 887 women who had the angle of progression measured just before pushing commenced. All of them had singleton cephalic pregnancies. And they found that an angle of progression that ranged from 108 to 119 degrees had the highest sensitivity for predicting subsequent vaginal delivery, while an angle of progression that ranged from 141 to 153 degrees had the highest specificity. So they had to pick in a receiver operator curve of that data, they had to pick a cutoff there somewhere. So they developed likelihood ratios for that data. And so if the angle was between 108 and 119 degrees, it had a positive likelihood ratio of 1.8. And if it was negative, if it was below that, it was a negative likelihood ratio of 0.13. But as this angle went up, it got better. So 120 to 140 degrees had a positive likelihood ratio of 3, and 141 to 153 degrees had a positive likelihood ratio of 3.7. So the greater the angle, the better. Now, how you would use those likelihood ratios is you would use a Fagan's nomogram. I don't know if we've ever talked about that on the podcast.
I don't think so.
I certainly talk about it in my book, and I'll put a link to a nice Fagan's nomogram for you to use. But a Fagan's nomogram allows you to update your pretest probability of a vaginal delivery for a given patient to determine the positive and negative predictive values depending upon what likelihood ratio, positive or negative, you use. So if that concept's new to you, I guess you should read my book. But how could this be used? Since we know that cesareans are safer when they're performed earlier in the labor process, well, then knowing early on, perhaps, that a patient will inevitably need a cesarean could be a useful way to prevent complications from cesareans by doing it in a more timely manner before she's pushed for 3 hours or had a shoulder dystocia or whatever. But these studies so far haven't established a cutoff for when you would just tell a person she needs a cesarean as opposed to giving her a chance to push. So I think that the numbers will provide you some reassurance that a vaginal delivery is likely when the picture looks murky. If you're clinically worried about it, she has pushed for a while, or you're just worried about the size of her pelvis or something like that, I think it may help give you some courage that she's likely to be successful.
Okay. And that those numbers you covered were regarding spontaneous deliveries, but you've also been using it more with operative deliveries. So what are the predictive numbers for operative vaginal births?
You did births again. I like that. Well, yeah, I think that's where I really see it being used for now. So where I want to use this or see its utility is in a patient who has pushed for some threshold of time that we decided she was allowed to have but hasn't delivered the child. And now I need to decide whether or not a uncomplicated and safe operative delivery is a good choice for her or not. Sometimes it helps me encourage the mother that it's a good thing to do because some women are hesitant about yielding to the vacuum or forceps and they just want to proceed with cesarean. So in September of this year, there was a meta-analysis of 7 studies published that sought to evaluate the ability of the angle of progression to predict an uncomplicated operative vaginal delivery. And these 7 studies included 782 patients, and the angle was measured in these patients during the second stage of labor. Some studies measured it in between contractions with no pushing, and others did it with pushing. But the review concluded that the angle of progression was a reliable predictor of an uncomplicated operative vaginal delivery. So the study identified a predictive cutoff for a favorable angle of progression was somewhere between 120 and 145.5 degrees at rest, or 120 and 160.9 degrees while pushing. So in other words, some angle in the middle of that range is where the receiver operator curve and flex is the optimal number. So a good or supportive angle of progression would be greater than either 145.5 if you measured it without pushing, or greater than 160 if she was pushing. And conversely, a poor predictor would be an angle less than 120 degrees in either case. Now, given these values, they also developed likelihood ratios, and these are stronger. I think they're more useful. Likelihood ratios less than 5 are a lot of times not useful enough to change our clinical ideas or opinions, but you'll see these likelihood ratios are better. So in nulliparous women, the positive likelihood ratio, if you were above 145.5 at rest, was 8.3 for a successful uncomplicated vaginal delivery, and for all women, it was 5.2. For vacuums in particular, it was 6.0, and for forceps, it was right under 6. And the negative likelihood ratio the other way around for nulliparous women, say with forceps, was 0.11. So these are significant likelihood ratios that should really make you think differently about it. So I'll give you an example now of how to do that with the Fagan's nomogram. If you had a patient and you assume that she had a 65% chance of success, now why would you assume that? Maybe it reflects your primary section rate in that population of a patient, or particularly a patient who's maybe pushed for 2 hours but hasn't been successful. For whatever reason, you assume that she only has a 65% chance of success before you measure the angle of progression, and then you measure it and find out it's 110 degrees, which is not a good number. Then if you put that in the Fagan's nomogram, you'd find out that our chance of an uncomplicated forceps delivery would only be 17%. Whereas if you had measured an angle of 146 degrees or greater with no pushing, then the chance would be 92% that she would have an uncomplicated forceps vaginal delivery. So that's really good, I think. And to me, those numbers are good enough that I would probably attempt forceps or vacuum in the favorable case and maybe just say we should probably do a C-section in the unfavorable case. So this is where I see it's useful to me and how I've been using it. But we really need further research to know which level of risk and things like that would just be a stop sign for attempting an operative delivery. And a lot more data is needed to fine-tune some of this. Now, in last month, in November, there was a systematic analysis published that concluded that measurements of the angle of progression conducted with pushing have a better prognostic value, and also found that transperineal ultrasound measurements of head to perineum distances are more accurate. So that's essentially measuring and maybe that's what we do for some of this too. I mean, just simply realizing that an ultrasound measurement and not filling the caput is a useful thing. But a lot of people are thinking about ways of using these data. So I think future research will come up with predictive tools that maybe combine the angle with or without pushing plus the head to perineum distance and things like that, and come up with maybe an algorithm or a calculator to tell us really what the risks are, or chances of success, I should say, with operative vaginal deliveries instead of a cesarean. So I think that's where I'm using it.
I wonder if that could, in the large scale, help reduce the risk of chorioamnionitis, if measuring that distance could eliminate doing a cervical check as often.
We do too many cervical exams, that's for sure. And we should talk about that sometime on maybe a thing we do for no reason, like Q2-hour cervical exams.
Yeah. Well, when we talked about this previously, you thought one of the promises of it would be that it could help lower the rate of cesarean delivery for some patients. So if someone has been pushing for 3 hours or so and they don't seem to be making very reassuring, encouraging progress, then a lot of physicians might be torn between proceeding with cesarean versus trial of operative vaginal delivery or even giving her more time. But you mentioned a study that suggested that this could lead to lower cesareans by giving more information in that clinical situation, which is where it sounds like you've been actually using it.
Yeah. So in October of this year, there was a study which evaluated the use of the angle of progression measurement for patients with uncertain fetal head engagement. Now, 1 in 25 pregnancies who have a prolonged second stage, meaning more than 2 hours, actually have uncertain fetal head engagement by digital exam, particularly if there's just a ton of caput secundum present. So in this situation, instrumental delivery is typically thought of as being risky, and a cesarean is usually recommended. But it turns out 2/3 of women in this situation are capable of giving birth vaginally. So the authors conducted a randomized pragmatic trial that included just 45 patients. We're talking about a fairly unusual patient, right? Somebody's been pushing for 2 hours and you can't tell if it's engaged or not. But still, had an independent investigator would measure the angle with pushing. And if it was greater than 120 degrees, then the managing obstetrician was encouraged to attempt vaginal birth. And in the intervention group, cesarean delivery was 12.5% compared to 41% if they didn't do these measurements in the control group, with no differences in maternal or neonatal outcomes and no cases of failed operative vaginal delivery. So they reduce the rate of C-section in these sort of margin cases.
You told me about a couple pregnancies recently where the baby was occiput posterior and the mothers had pushed for 3 hours or so. Are there studies that talk about that particular presentation and how useful is the angle in that scenario?
Yeah, there's a, actually an older study from January of 2021, found that women whose fetuses were in the occiput posterior position were, of course, more likely to undergo cesarean delivery in general. But in this case, they were more likely to undergo C-section and more likely to just have persistent OP presentation if the angle was less than 121 degrees. So again, somewhere around 120. So this knowledge, I think, could help guide us about earlier interventions for occiput posterior presentation, such as manual or operative rotation.
So maybe how this becomes useful is if people use this measurement and they gain some confidence that in someone with a favorable angle, that continued efforts at pushing or offering operative assistance will be fruitful, as opposed to just proceeding with the cesarean at 2 or 3 hours of pushing and dealing with a deeply impacted head at that point. I suppose you could make an argument for always offering a trial of operative vaginal delivery, and then if it fails, proceeding with cesarean. But in reality, that's not what most obstetricians do, and that's not necessarily the most ideal scenario if you can avoid it. But if this angle of progression number can give them some confidence that eventual vaginal delivery, however it happens, is very likely to occur, then it might just encourage some more patience on their part and, you know, in that way, maybe prevent unnecessary cesareans from happening.
Yeah, so it's interesting. And I think all this will play out over the next little while about how we can start to use this more and more. It definitely has given me some confidence in attempting operative deliveries where the picture is unclear due to how long they've been pushing. And I also did the opposite recently, where I went ahead and did a cesarean for a patient that I was worried about after several hours of pushing, 3 or 4 hours, and she had an unfavorable angle. And after delivering the baby by cesarean and seeing how it was so deeply wedged in there and how much cone there was and just what the shape of her pelvis was like, I thought that was a good decision. And it's helped me in the opposite way as well, particularly in convincing a patient who was very hesitant about delivery. And I could actually tell her, I think you have an excellent chance of an uncomplicated operative delivery based upon this number. So I do see utility for it.
Okay. Well, I'll be following along and hopefully I'll be able to try this, get familiar with this soon myself. Well, I think we can move on for now. We should mention there's a new study from the December Green Journal, an article called "The Association Between Obesity and Fetal Acidosis at Scheduled Cesarean Delivery."
You mean birth?
Well, I guess.
Contact the editor.
I guess ACOG isn't very consistent sometimes with their words. But anyway, we were talking recently in our last episode about how fast to go at the time of cesarean. And one of the factors associated with fetal acidosis was maternal obesity. So the study looked at about 6,000 women who were undergoing a scheduled cesarean, and about half of those were obese and half were not. And they found that the obese patients were 2.7 times more likely to have an umbilical cord artery pH below 7.1 and about over three times as likely to have an umbilical artery base deficit 12 or greater. They did know, as you might expect, that obese patients had a longer interval from starting the neuraxial anesthesia. So these were all neuraxial, not general anesthesia patients like we were talking about before, but longer interval between starting the neuraxial to delivering, because of course it just takes longer to deliver a baby in an obese mother than in a non-obese mother. But they actually found that the time difference didn't account for the differences in the cord gases. So even when those were controlled for, the babies were still more likely to be acidotic. So they speculated that this may be due to issues related to background placental compromise or poor perfusion, perhaps due to the obesity itself. And just as another quick throwback to another one of our prior episodes, I think that theory is why ACOG suggests obese women now should go have antepartum testing in their pregnancies.
Despite a lack of rigorous data that says it's helpful. But yeah, that definitely there's something there. But I don't think that this adds to the last episode, but I don't think it changes our bottom line, which was essentially that we should try to have these babies birthed within 4 minutes of starting the surgery. But it does remind us that sometimes the patients who benefit the most from some of the things we do are the ones for whom it's hardest to do those things in. So perfect your standardized evidence cesarean technique, work on separating those rectus muscles without dissecting them off the fascia in every single case. Use blunt entry after incising the uterus and all those things, and we should be able to consistently get these babies out in under 4 minutes.
And also use angle of progression if you can. Well, I think that wraps it up for today. So thinking about OBGYN website, we'll have links to what we discussed, and we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Thanks for listening. Find us online at thinkingaboutobgyn.com. Be sure to subscribe. Look for new episodes every 2 weeks.